Will Rogers, Ambassador of Goodwill, Prince of Wit and Wisdom, by P.J. O'Brien, with an appreciation by Lowell Thomas. Will Rogers, the character and the temperament of an age as well as its common sense are reflected in its laughter. So says Dr. J.C. Gregory in his treatise on the sense of humor. He remarks further, "The way men laugh and the things they laugh at reflect their tastes, thoughts, and sympathies. Society offers its pulse in the nature of its laughter." The career of Will Rogers is the finest illustration you could find of those observations. If we hadn't had him during the last 10 years, if we hadn't appreciated him and had the sense to laugh with him or at ourselves, we should have been a sad people. He first burgeoned out as the smiling prophet of America in the era of the Great Insanity, the period we remember because of the tragic comedy of the Teapot Dome, which culminated in the cataclysm of November 1929. Politico Magnifico's worried and denounced, editors exploded in 12-point type. Rogers poured out a steady stream of sparkling common sense that helped us maintain some sort of perspective. When the Depression descended upon us in such volume that not even the most ostrich-minded could deny it, the man from Oklahoma stuck out among us as a flashy tower of sanity, and people listened to him. Historians and economists tried to remind us that there had been previous depressions and that the Republic had survived, but we needed the droll, jovial gags of Will Rogers to make us keep our feet on the ground. One of the finest facts about him was that he never took a crack at any man, either a man, a party, or a class, unless he or it was riding cockily on top of the world. For example, his most ludicrous comment upon bankers was delivered at a time when they were the sacred white cows of every editorial office in America. It was in 1924 that Rogers came out with the paragraph, "Vanderlip made a speech at the Rotary Club of Sing Sing, New York, that astonished the United States. Rotaries comprised of one of the best of each line of work or business. Mr. Vanderlip must have felt right at home up there. There are more bankers at Sing Sing than any other town of its size in the United States." If that had been said in 1933, it would have been an obvious, almost cowardly jab. But at the time that Rogers published it, bankers were still the high priests of finance, quoted with reverence upon any subject, from world politics to birth control. After the pendulum had swung, after they had become a general target for abuse, Rogers declined to join the chorus. Instead, he turned the fire of his comedic machine guns upon the people who were kicking the bankers. As he himself said, with his unforgettable grin, "I'm always agin the party that's up." At the height of the Teapot Dome scandal, he kidded Senator Walsh, the prosecutor, as merrily as he did Sinclair and Donaghy. Later on, when the bankers were in the pillory, Rogers aimed his most pointed barbs at their inquisitors, Senator Black and Counselor Ferdy Pecora. On all such occasions, the essence of his quality was that he made everybody like it. Some of us winced a bit, but after we had caught our breath, we all had to join in the laughter. Since his death, the pundits have been saying that Rogers had not as deep a background of philosophy as Mark Twain. How Will would have chuckled at the suggestion. But if you consider his jesting as a whole, you will see that the gum-chewing master of the lariat had one of the soundest and oldest of all philosophies in the world, a fine scorn for all shams and pretensions. It was always the bumptious, the posers, at whom he poked the most fun. He had an amazing faculty for penetrating poses, equaled only by his ability to do it without venom. One of the principal differences between him and Mark Twain was that Rogers lacked capacity for the fierce indignation to which Clemens gave vent in his later years. In describing Innocents Abroad, Stephen Leacock had aptly observed that Mark Twain could see Europe more clearly from the top of the Rockies than could the people walking in the Rue de Rivoli or sitting around the Forum in Rome. Rogers had a good measure of the same faculty. He could see not only Europe, but his own country, but it never made him indignant. the only pose in Will Rogers was the pretense that he was an ignorant and illiterate fellow. Actually, he was nothing of the sort. As he once remarked, we are all of us ignorant, but not about the same things. Though he made a bluff at concealing it, his writings from time to time betrayed an exceedingly wide knowledge. Whether he was conscious of it or not, the system behind his humor was an exceedingly old one. It can be described in one word, truth. It is one of the most ancient formula of the comic spirit. As Max Eastman has remarked, truth is a chief source of the joy motive in popular jokes. We are always hungry for the simple truth. That, in the last analysis, is what Will Rogers gave us. Signed, Lowell Thomas. Chapter 1. The Tragedy of the Tundra. In the weird half-light of a summer night, in the far north, a red, low-winged monoplane skimmed gracefully along the surface of the shallow river that pierced the bleak Alaskan tundra. The ship gained speed, climbed a scanty 50 feet, and then plunged awkwardly, out of control, to the water below. It was as if some invisible hunter with a powerful, silent weapon had sent a lethal charge into the gaily colored, man-made bird. No one moved in the broken plane. Its occupants had made their final landing. Thus did Will Rogers, beloved prince of wit and wisdom, and Wiley Post, master aviator, meet their end in the barren wilderness a few miles from the last outpost of civilization in North America. Only a terrified Eskimo seal hunter saw the ship as it crashed into the edge of the little unnamed stream, and in his fright, he ran away from the tangled wreckage of the once roaring machine of his white-faced brothers. As the echo of the crash rolled away over the Hamakati tundra, the native Claire Okpia made his way back to the riverbank and shouted loudly to the men in the plane. There was no answer, only the Arctic stillness. Realizing that the occupants of the plane were beyond his aid, Okpia set out to bring the news of the disaster to Point Barrow, 15 miles away, northernmost point on the continent where the United States Army Signal Corps maintains a radio station. Over the dry hammocks, through the little streams wending their way into the Arctic Ocean and around tiny lakes, where nested the white whistling swans and the black-necked geese, the Eskimo walked and raced until 3 hours later he reached the settlement. Exhausted, he stopped near the radio shack to gasp out to a group of natives, "Birdmen dead. Red bird blow up." Staff Sergeant Stanley R. Morgan of the Signal Corps, the only representative of the government north of latitude 71, heard the native story, and from his pidgin English, the soldier knew that the plane was that of Post and that the passenger was Will Rogers. Out into the Arctic night went Sergeant Morgan to round up a crew of Eskimo seal hunters to go to the scene. In a whaleboat kicked along by an outboard motor, they churned their way southward through the little streams and across the tiny ponds. It was several hours later before they came upon the wreckage. The plane lay on its back in 2 feet of water. Its right wing was crumpled, its engine jammed back into the cockpit. His daughter's picture. In Roger's pocket was his Ingersoll watch, still ticking, showing the time at 3:30 a.m. On Post watch was a smashed watch showing the time 8:18 p.m., the time of the crash on August 15, 1935. Both bodies were wrapped in blankets and placed in an omiak, an Eskimo open boat made of skin stretched over a frame. From Roger's coat fell a newspaper clipping bearing the picture of his 18-year-old daughter Mary, who at the time was playing with a summer theater group in Maine in a play entitled Ceiling Zero. By a strange coincidence, the drama has for its climax a fatal airplane crash. The crash. Back at Point Barrow, Sergeant Morgan dashed to his radio key to tell the world of the tragedy. His report, as wirelessed to the War Department at Washington, gave a graphic description of the crash as obtained from Okpia. It read, at 10 p.m. last night, attracted by a group of excited natives on the beach, walking down discovered one native all out of breath, gasping in pidgin English a strange tale of airplane she blow up. After repeated questioning, learned this native witnessed crash of an airplane at his sealing camp some 15 miles south of Barro and had run the entire distance to summon aid. Native claimed plane flying very low suddenly appeared from the south and apparently sighted tent. Plane then circled several times and finally settled upon small river near camp. Two men climbed out, one wearing rag on sore eye and the other big man with boots. The big man then called native to the water's edge and asked distance and direction to Point Barro. Direction given, men then climbed back into the plane and taxied off to far side of river for takeoff into wind. After a short run, plane slowly lifted from water to height about 50 feet, banking slightly to the right, when evidently motor stalled. Plane slipped off on right wing and nosed down into water, turning completely over. Native claimed dull explosion occurred and most of right wing dropped off and a film of gasoline and oil soon covered the water. Native, frightened by explosion, turned and ran, but soon controlled fright and returned, calling loudly to men in plane. Receiving no answer, then made decision to come to Barro for help. With completion of the story, we knew plane to be that of Post and Rogers and quickly assembled a crew of 14 Eskimos and departed in an open whaleboat powered with small gas motor. Hampered by recent ice flows and strong adverse current, took nearly 3 hours to reach destination. Dense fog with semi-darkness gave upturned plane most ghostly appearance, and our hearts chilled at the thought of what we might find there. As we approached nearer the plane, we realized that no human could possibly survive the terrific crash. The plane was but a huge mass of twisted and broken wood and metal. The natives by this time had managed to cut into the cabin and extricate the body of Rogers, who apparently had been well back in the cabin when the plane struck and was more or less protected by the baggage carried therein. We soon learned we would have a difficult time freeing Post from the wreckage, as the plane had struck with such terrific speed it had forced the engine well back into the cabin, pinning the body of Post securely. With some difficulty, we managed to tear the plane apart and eventually released the body of Post. Both bodies were then carefully laid and wrapped with eiderdown sleeping bags found in the wreckage and then carefully placed in the boat. It is believed the natives felt the loss of these two great men as keenly as we. As we started back to Barro, one of the Eskimo boys began to sing a hymn in Eskimo, and soon all voices whined in the singing and continued it until our arrival at Barro, where we silently bore the bodies from the beach to the hospital, where they were turned over to Dr. Henry Christ, who, with the kindly help of Charles D. Braro, prepared and dressed the bodies. It is doubtful if a person in this little village slept that night. All sat around the hospital with bowed heads, with little or no talking. King Charlie of the Arctic. Dr. Christ, mentioned in the report, abandoned his Indiana medical practice in 1920 to go as a Presbyterian medical missionary to Alaska. Rogers and Post were on their way to visit Brower, known as King Charlie to the Eskimos, who had lived under the flaming lights of the Aurora Borealis for 51 years. He left his home in New York at the age of 21 to go to the Arctic. It was only a trifling 10-minute hop from the scene of the crash to Point Barro, but it was sufficient to bring a violent end to what had started as an aerial vacation that would have taken them leisurely around the world by way of Alaska, Siberia, China, Russia, and possibly Ethiopia. Rogers joined Post in Seattle, and 2 days later, they took off for Juneau. Post was well known in Alaska because of two flights around the world, but it was the first visit of Rogers to the country, and everywhere crowds gathered to cheer him and shake his hand. Before taking off from Seattle, Mrs. Post, according to Rogers, asked him to take care of Willie, and he replied, Of course you mean in the air, after we get on the ground. Wiley is able to look after himself. Rogers in rare humor. Rogers was a high humor on the trip. At Fairbanks, he joked about the salmon fishing of which the residents boasted. All these boys do is brag about who caught the biggest salmon, Will declared. Last night an oil man brought one weighing 50 pounds to my room and wanted to put it in bed with me. I can't see the use of catching salmon when they crawl out of the water to meet you. The first handshake I got when I stepped ashore was from a big coho. A coho, they tell me, is a king salmon that's on relief. After their stay at Fairbanks, Rogers and Post took to the air to fly the 500-mile stretch to Point Barrow. The weather was none too good when they started out, but Post decided that if they ran into adverse conditions, they would sit down on one of the numerous lakes in the barren, frostbitten country. A radio report from Barrow shortly after their departure indicated they would encounter fog and poor visibility over most of their route. 50 miles out from Fairbanks, the blinding Arctic fog closed in. Ahead of them was the Brooks Range with its snow-capped peaks. They dared not go on. Post brought the plane down on Harding Lake and waited for the weather to clear. They were impatient to be on the way, and as soon as the visibility lifted, they decided to try it. On the wing again, they chose to poke their way through the fog in order to reach Point Barrow. When they figured they were close to their destination, they came down close to the ground in the hope of finding some landmark that would show them the way. When they saw the Eskimos' camp, Post decided to land and ask the way to Point Barrow. The missing of Point Barrow was no reflection on Post's ability as an aerial navigator. Veteran flyers, who had flown the route numerous times, lost their bearings on several occasions when they encountered fog, and, if anything, it was a tribute to Post's skill that he came within 15 miles of the objective. During the brief stop on the Tundra River, Wiley tinkered with the engine and Will gabbed with the Eskimo, as might be expected. Undoubtedly, from that lone seal hunter, Rogers found material for a jest that he intended to relate sometime, for anywhere he went, he saw something with a humorous twist in it. Even his tech-to-turn flying companion was a fitting subject, and in one of his last pieces of writing, he said of Post, "Wiley is kinder of a Calvin Coolidge on answers. None of them are going to bother you with being too long." After obtaining the direction of Point Barrow, Post sent the plane across the river for a takeoff into the wind, flying speed across the water. What happened? No one knows. Whatever it was beyond the skill of any flyer to overcome, for Willie Post was rated as one of the greatest pilots that ever lived. An airlock in the gasoline feed line, or the sudden freezing of the carburetor due to the failure of the superheater to act properly, have been suggested as the cause. The engine quit, and without sufficient height, it was impossible to bring the ship under control. Arctic flight hazardous. Flying in the Arctic, where such noted pilots as Carl Ben Eielson and Frank Dorbeck perished, is a terrible ordeal at all times, according to flying men who have braved its hazards many times. In the region of Point Barrow, there is ice and snow most of the year, and in the few weeks of summer, there is soft sand to make it difficult to take off and land. Fog and mist arise suddenly to blind the flyer and throw him off his course. And as for storms, the flyers call northern Alaska the breeding ground of cyclones. Joe Croissant, hero of many an Arctic flight, advised the two vacationists to remain at Fairbanks until the weather cleared before hopping off for Point Barrow. But Post and Rogers were long accustomed to flying as a matter of everyday business, and they faced the hazards in the spirit of fun. "If we meet bad weather," said Rogers, "we'll just set down, open a can of chili, and throw a party until it clears." And so their red ship soared into the midst of Fairbanks and disappeared to the north. Croissant watched them depart, and as a flyer, his thought was of the plane. "There's a ship to go places with," he said. "With that engine, Wiley could lift her out of a frog pond." The thermometer registered 45 degrees at the time of the start, and there were reports of dense fog along the way, but Croissant felt no concern, for he I felt that the plane, as well made and as powerfully engined as it was, in the hands of a flyer like Willie Post, could get through regardless of fog. Before leaving for Point Barrow, Rogers had told friends in Alaska that after going to Siberia, they planned to go to strange places and eventually come back to America by way of Iceland and Greenland. Their long water jump by the indefinite route they had outlined was about 1,000 miles, but Rogers seemed to think little of that. Crisan did not agree with him. He was of the opinion that such a long flight over water was a grave hazard. Off for somewhere. There was something almost prophetic in one of the last articles Rogers wrote before his death. It was entitled, "Off for Somewhere in a Red Bus." Off for somewhere. The words seemed to envision the tragic ending on the tundra. But both men died as they wished. Post, in commenting on his pioneering flights into the stratosphere, once said, "I know it's dangerous, but if I get popped off, that's the way I want to do. Doing the things that I want to do." Once it had been arranged to carry Rogers on a night flight from Dallas to Chicago in a mail plane, he declined to ride in the plane under a waiver when he learned that the plane was not authorized to carry passengers. He chartered a plane and followed the mail plane to Chicago. "We should not break the rules," Rogers commented. "And then, too, I would have had to have ridden on a parachute if I had flown in the mail plane. Picture this farm boy dangling from a parachute. I'll always come in with the plane." In a speech he made in Boston in 1930, Rogers told of the epitaph he wanted placed on his grave. "When I die," he said, "my epitaph, or whatever you call those signs on gravestones, is going to read, 'I joked about every prominent man of my time, but I never met a man I didn't like.' I'm proud of that. I can hardly wait to die so it can be carved. And when you come around to my grave, you'll probably find me sitting there proudly reading it." Will Rogers, Ambassador of Goodwill, Prince of Wit and Wisdom, Chapter 2. Rogers' Boyhood. When Will Rogers first saw the light of day in a ranch house in the old Indian Territory, now the state of Oklahoma, his mother, a devout Methodist, hoped he would grow up to be a minister of the gospel. She cherished this dream until he ran away from home, which caused a relative to prophesy that young Will was destined to be hanged as a horse thief. Neither of these expectations, of course, materialized, and no one foresaw that the drawling, loose-jointed cowboy was ordained to become a preacher of the finest kind of doctrine, the best-loved American of his time, and the favorite of statesmen, presidents, and kings. Will Rogers was born November 4, 1879. Jokingly, he used to claim that his birthday was an election day and that it gave him the natural right to poke fun at those who sat in the highest chancelleries of government all over the world. His own explanation of the place of his birth was halfway between Claremore and Ooligua, where before there was a town in either place. He claimed Claremore for convenience, he said, because nobody but an Indian can pronounce Ooligua. His parents, Clement Van Rogers and Mary Schimsker Rogers, both had Cherokee Indian blood in their veins. They came from pioneer stock. Those two facts were a great satisfaction to Rogers in his later life, and he frequently remarked, "My ancestors didn't come over in the Mayflower. They met the boat." Father, an Indian trader. Will's father fought in the Civil War as an officer on the Confederate side and afterwards operated a trading post where he dealt profitably with the Osage Indians. He quit trading to become a cattleman. Of his parents, Rogers once said, "My father was 1/8 Cherokee and my mother 1/4 Cherokee, which I figure makes me about 1/8 cigar store Indian." Regardless of genetics and the Mendelian law, Will Rogers undoubtedly drew upon all three strains, Irish, Scotch, and American Indian, to fashion the character that was so beloved by the world. From the Irish came his sense of humor, roguish as it was, and his great, generous heart. The Scotch added a keen sense of business and forthrightness, and from the Indian came the dignity and reserve that prevented him, as the nation's jester, from descending to a level of a Mary Andrew. Will was impressively baptized William Penn Adair Rogers, the only boy among six girls in the family. His first callers, as he lay in the cradle in the comfortable ranch house, were the cowboys from the Rogers Ranch. A miniature of the house was built by the school children of Ulagu in honor of Rogers in 1930. It stands on a plot in the center of town. At Claremore, a few years before Rogers' death, the Pocahontas Club, an Indian organization of which he was an honorary member, feted Will Rogers at a dinner. Among the guests was one of the cowboys who had seen Will shortly after his birth. The cowboy, dressed in a range-riding outfit with leather chaps, stood in a corner as Oklahoma's most famous native son came into the banquet hall. Rogers looked at the white-haired old plainsman and recognized him immediately. He rushed over to him. "Barney, you old rascal, how are you getting along?" The old man recalled how he had seen Will when he was only 6 weeks old. "I realized then," Barney declared, "you would never take a prize in a beauty contest. Your mother looked up at me. I can see her smile now. She said, 'Barney, I know what you're thinking, but he isn't much for looks, but I know he's going to be one of the best boys that ever lived.'" Tears shone in Roger's blue eyes. "There was something mighty peculiar about that first time I saw you," said the old cowboy. "What was that?" asked Will. "You were speechless." The joke sent Rogers into a spasm of laughter. He thoroughly enjoyed being on the receiving end of a good gag for once in his life. Rogers often pretended he did not know the exact date of his birth, and from the standpoint of show business, it was a shrewd thing not to reveal one's exact age. "Well," Will told an interviewer one day, "I was born, of course. You've got to be born, and that's about the only thing you've got to do to get on the stage. I don't know what year the great event took place, but I'm supposed to be a good many years on the trail. I was born the year after the cattle had died from a blizzard in our country, and any longhorn will tell you when that was." That birth certificate. One of Will Rogers' best stories, of which there are numerous versions, had to do with the question of a birth certificate as prerequisite for a passport to Europe. A young lady clerk, according to Will, presented him with an application blank to fill out in an affidavit to be sworn by someone concerning the place of his birth. "I told her," he said, "that I had no birth certificate, and as far as someone present at my birth and can swear to it, I think that's going to be rather difficult. You know, the old-time ladies of which I am a direct descendant were of a retiring nature, and being born was a private affair, not a public function. In the early days of the Indian Territory, where I was born, there were no such things as birth certificates. You being there as certificate enough. We generally took it for granted that if you were there, you must have been born. That was about the only thing we didn't dispute. Having a certificate of being born was like wearing a raincoat in the water over a bathing suit." Will finally solved the difficulty when a friend volunteered to swear to the affidavit. The friend, he said, knew Will's father well. "Now, he had never been west of the Hudson River," said Rogers, "and my father had never been east of the Mississippi, so it was one of the longest distance friendships on record. I thought it was funny he never mentioned knowing father before to me." Will's father, to whom he called the chief, was moderately well-to-do and stood high in the cow country. The elder Rogers was a member of the convention that drafted the Oklahoma State Constitution, and a county was named for him. Will often laughed at that. He said, "Shucks, they had to change the name. Nobody could pronounce the old one, Cowie Sue Cowie." Born bow-legged. By the time he was 5 years old, Will Rogers could ride a horse, and he often said that, "Like other Oklahoma kids, I was born bow-legged so I could set on a horse." The infant also twirled a rope in imitation of his elders, and he gained remarkable proficiency, so much so that when he was 14, he was rated as a top cowhand and roper. He gained that recognition when he entered a rodeo in competition with older cowboys and won a riding and roping contest. Rogers loved horses and the wild, free life of the open range, but his father and mother planned that their son should have more than a desolatory schooling which the territory afforded. It must have been a sad day indeed for the fun-loving boy when he was told he must quit the rolling prairie for the restricted campus of a boarding school. Will was sent to a school in Neosho, Missouri, where it seems the only thing for which he distinguished himself was an imitation of a colored preacher. This was given on Friday afternoons at the recitation period by popular demand. He next went to the Kemper Military Academy at Boonville in the same state, only to remain a little while. I went to pretty nearly every school in the country for a little while, Rogers used to say, except West Point. I could have gone there too, only I was too proud to talk to a congressman at military school. But life at the military school, with its strict regulations and form-fitting tunics, must have been the last straw for the restless youth from the plains, for he wrote his father that he was going to skip school and help some fellers dig an oil well in Texas. The elder Rogers told him to go ahead and work out his own salvation. Digging for oil proved an irksome task, and Will bombarded his home with letters telling of his privations in the oil fields and his homesickness for the ranch. His father laughed at the letters, and then, when he decided the son had been taught a lesson, sent him money to come home. Back at the ranch, the chief told Willie, as he called him, that his school days were over and that it was high time he had taken over some of the responsibility of the ranch. The elder Rogers named his son steward of the ranch and gave him the power of attorney on the family bank account. The father then left on a business trip. The first thing Will proceeded to do was build a dance platform where he staged dancing and roping contests. It was all a celebration, Will said, of his return home and the end of the confining school days. In all, he spent about $1,000 of his father's money, and that was a pile of money in them days. Young Rogers won many of the dancing prizes because of his skill at strutting the cakewalk, which was then coming into vogue in that section of the country. The storm broke when his father returned. The power of attorney was revoked, and Will was thrown upon his own resources, riding the range. Undaunted, the youth saddled a pony and rode away. On a nearby ranch, he found work as a cowhand, and one of his first tasks was helping in the dehorning of 3,000 steers. Years later, Percy Gassaway, congressman from Oklahoma and a former cowboy, told of working on that ranch, which was owned by Colonel W.P. Ewing. Gassaway said he noticed a youth sitting on the fence of the corral, doing nothing but cracking jokes all the time. Finally, Gassaway asked Ewing, "Why is he staying around?" Colonel Ewing laughed and replied, "In the first place, he's so funny I can't let him go, and in the second place, I'm just wondering if he'll ever do anything." Eventually, his father forgot the celebration over the ending of Will's school days and took him back into the good graces of the family. He was given a herd of cattle of his own, and he raised them until they were worth $12,000. Then Roger's vagabond spirit began to itch the soles of his feet, and he longed to be on the way to faraway places. He was 21 when he sold his herd, and with another young cowboy started for the Argentine. "When a fellow ain't got much mind," Will commented years later, "it don't take him long to make it up." The pair of youthful adventurers went to New Orleans, where they hoped to get a boat for the South American cow country, but they were advised to go to New York. On arriving there, they were told that this year's boat for Buenos Aires had gone, and it was suggested that they go to England, where there was a regular line to the Argentine. They went that way, but Rogers was seasick most of the journey, and his diet for the entire trip, he said later on, was a couple of lemons. The flip of a coin. Eventually, the two got jobs punching cattle on the Pampas for the equivalent of $4.20 a month. This was not anything like the rosy dreams with which they had started out from Oklahoma, and by the time most of the money Rogers had obtained from the sale of the cattle was gone. Will's buddy developed a bad case of homesickness, and there was only enough money to pay for the fare home for one of them. They flipped a coin, and Rogers' companion won. Will remained behind, working with the gauchos. Of that time, Rogers relates the following. I was sort of itching to show these gauchos how I could rope and tie down a steer. One day they wanted to catch one to put a brand on him, so I takes down my little manila rope. I even went so far as to pick out the exact spot I was going to lay the steer down. Well, I hadn't even got close enough to start swinging my rope when I heard something go whizzing over my head. A guy running about 20 feet behind me had thrown clear over my head and caught the steer. Why, he could rope a steer better than I could shoot a guy with a Winchester. Goes to Boer War. Meanwhile, the Boer War was being fought in South Africa, and young Rogers longed to go there. Broke, but still smiling and wisecracking, he got a job on a cattle boat as valet to a cargo of mules to Cape Town. They were almost tame and didn't kick much, laughed Rogers in reminiscing about those days. At Ladysmith, he got a job as a remount station breaking horses. Shortly after this, the war came to a close, and the youthful wanderer was broke once more. And speaking of a service in the Boer War, Rogers frequently declared the war ended the day he landed in South Africa, but that was one of his countless jests. Rogers heard that an American showman named Texas Jack was at Johannesburg with his one-ring circus and Wild West show. Will made his way to town and found Texas Jack outside the tent doing a comparatively simple rope trick known as a spinning out. The showman offered $100 to any member of the crowd who could duplicate the feat. It looked like easy money to the Oklahoma cowboy, and he hurried to the show platform. There he picked up the rope, slouched over the edge of the platform, and with his blue eyes twinkling and his mouth twisted up in his familiar grin, spun out just as Texas had done. Then he threw in a few intricate tricks for good measure. The crowd thought it was part of the show and applauded enthusiastically. But to Rogers, it meant $100, and when he asked for it, he found out it was all a bluff. Texas Jack didn't have 100 dimes at that moment, but he offered Will a job in the show doing fancy riding and roping. Any chuck wagon to which he could attach himself looked good to him at that minute, and he accepted the job with alacrity, without much caring that what he was starting on, a career as a showman, which was to be unequaled by anyone in his lifetime. The Cherokee Kid. He was billed as the Cherokee Kid, and from the beginning was the star attraction of the show. From Africa, he worked his way with the show to New Zealand and Australia, where he joined the Worth Show, owned by Mayworth's father. May later became the greatest bareback riders in the history of the circus. With this show, Rogers went to Japan and China and eventually landed in San Francisco. This was 3 years after he had started out to see the world. From San Francisco, Will said, I bummed my way back to Ulga, and I heard a feller tell my dad he didn't think I had done so well because I came home wearing overalls for underwear. Then followed one of his occasional resting periods, and Rogers always described himself as one of the most accomplished resters on earth. But after his experiences, the cow town of Ugla and its dusty roads, tiny collection of stores, hitching racks, and plank sidewalks looked good to the young traveler. It was a welcome haven where three good meals were forthcoming daily. Will Rogers' indifferent education in his youth supplied him with much material for many of his best quips, and his most famous line was, Sure, I studied McGuffey's Fourth Reader for 10 years. Rogers liked that one, and showman that he was, he embellished it as the years went by. The next time he used it, he drawled, I studied McGuffey's Fourth Reader for 10 years. In the end, I knew more about it than McGuffey. Dressing up a joke. After a few more versions, it finally became quite an anecdote. My father was pretty well fixed, and I being the only male son, he tried terribly hard to make something out of me. He sent me to about every school in that part of the country. In some of them, I would last for 3 or 4 months. I got just as far as the fourth reader when the teachers wouldn't seem to be running the school right, and rather than have the school stop, I would generally leave. Then I would start in another school and tell them I had just finished the third reader and was ready for the fourth. Well, I knew all the fourth grade by heart, so the teacher would say, I never see you studying, yet you seem to know your lessons. I had that education thing figured down to a fine point. 10 years of McGuffey's fourth reader, and I knew more about it than McGuffey did. It was his delight to joke about his laggard days in school, and undoubtedly, he was not much of a student, but he could always make the class laugh when called upon to recite. Underneath Will Rogers' mask of ignorance was a well-mannered and cultured man with a shrewd, trained mind. He might have had college degrees to add to his name, had he so desired. Dr. Nicholas Murray Butler, president of Columbia University, met Rogers during an ocean voyage and became so impressed by his wit and wisdom that he told the former he would call him to Columbia to receive an honorary degree. Will grinned sheepishly and drawled, "Well, Dr. Butler, I know they give college degrees to pretty nearly every kind of ignorance, but I didn't know they gave any for my kind." Refuses college degrees. Other colleges sought to confer honors upon Rogers, but he refused them all. One of the reasons for this was that he was extremely modest and refused to believe that he was as great as he really was. In later years, as Rogers climbed the dizzy heights of fame, where his advice was sought by the nation's leaders, someone circulated the report that he was not the simple, ignorant cowboy he said that he was, but had actually been graduated from Oxford University. At first he smiled at the story, but as it went the rounds and many accepted it as fact, Will became much embarrassed. He finally exploded the rumor with one of his barbed shafts of wit. "It's a base canard," he said. "Nothing to it. Shucks. I always thought Oxford was the name of a shoe until I went to England a couple of years ago and they dragged me out to look at the college." While on the subject of education, Will could always find some utterance that would cause a laugh, but which contained a large kernel of wisdom. In the days when the college boys were going in for +4 knickers and Oxford bags, Rogers took one look at them and chuckled. "What the youth of this country needs is narrower pants and broader ideas." And once, while commenting on higher education, he declared, "College is wonderful because it takes the children away from the home just as they reach the arguing stage." On another occasion, a committee of citizens from Oklahoma came to Will and asked him to run for Congress, and he replied, "At old Willie Hassel College, I studied elocution for a while, and if I hadn't given it up then, I might take up your proposition now. In fact, I gave it up because I was afraid I'd get to be a senator." Gift of gab. Much of the cowboy's wit was on topics of the day, and it perished with the day. He viewed his own gift of gab humorously, as was shown on the occasion when asked to run for governor of Oklahoma against his old friend, Governor Alfalfa Bill Murray. "I won't run this time," he said, "though running in Oklahoma used to be about the best thing I did. When I was a kid in school, my nickname was Rabbit because I was so fast on my feet. A boy that gabbed as much about things that were none of his business as I did had to be fast on his feet." The citizens of Oklahoma, however, found a way to pay him an honor when a new 6-story hotel was built in Claymore. They named the structure Will Rogers Hotel and called them back to the town to help dedicate it. After inspecting it, Will remarked, "Why, this has more bathrooms than Buckingham Palace." "When I was a kid in this town," he continued, "I used to envy General Grant and Jesse James because they had cigars named after them. But shucks, I've got it on them now." Will Rogers, Ambassador of Goodwill, Prince of Wit and Wisdom. Chapter 3. A Cowboy's Courtship. The younger generation of the little frontier cow town of Oogala was in a fever of excitement when Will Rogers arrived home after his travels in South Africa, the Antipodes, and the Orient. But the agitation was not occasioned by the return of the prodigal. No fatted calf was slaughtered in honor of his coming, for the meanderings of a cowboy were taken for granted, and for all it mattered, Will might just as well have been working in the neighboring county. The flurry was caused by a pretty girl with whom Will proceeded to fall in love at first sight, but he was too shy even to seek an introduction. She was Betty Blake, a young lady in her teens, and the sister of the Oogala Depot agent. She had come to the little town on a visit from her home in Arkansas. The bicycle craze was just sweeping the country, and young Rogers was one of the first in his section to procure one. A born showman, he decided on a campaign to win the young lady's attention. Miss Blake was seated on her porch one day when Will came tearing down the dusty road on his new two-wheeler. He planned to show her some trick riding, just as he had seen cyclists perform in his travels. Something went wrong, for the trick ended in midair, and Will landed on his head. Betty rushed to his aid, and as she wiped the blood from a slight cut, he grinned and drawled, "Guess I better stick to cow ponies." That was the beginning, and thereafter the courtship was concluded in a rubber-tired buggy. In later years, Rogers always smilingly declared that he wore out a set of the tires driving Betty around trying to get her to say yes. At any rate, Betty left for her home in Rogers, Arkansas, where she became a school teacher, and Will went back trooping with a Wild West show, which he joined in Oklahoma. From there, he went on to big time vaudeville, and with a comfortable salary assured, Rogers thought once more of the pretty girl he had left behind in the Southwest. The beauties he met along Broadway and in show business meant nothing to him. Rogers was part of the glamorous nightlife of New York's most brilliant period, but he did not belong to it. In November 1908, he hurried down to Arkansas and there took the bride who was to be his only partner and sweetheart through the years that he was climbing from a cowhand vaudeville performer to a place in international fame. The ceremony was performed in the modest two-story frame house where the young schoolteacher made her home. "It was the luckiest thing that ever happened to me," Rogers frequently declared. "Betty is the blame for all of it. Whatever I am or have accomplished, I owe to Betty. I ain't got no sense. My wife made me what I am. In other words, local girl makes good in the city, makes good man." The perfect match. In the hurly-burly of the theatrical world, where divorce was common occurrence, the Rogers marriage was classed as the perfect match. Just before his death, Will commented on his stardom in the movies. "I'm not a real movie star. I still got the same wife I started out with nearly 28 years ago." And 3 days after his death, Mrs. Rogers received the last expression of his affection for her. It was a small package addressed to her at Beverly Hills, California. The name and address were written in the careless, rambling scrawl that was Will's typical handwriting. In the box was a small red fox fur, a souvenir of the country where he had met his end. It was sent from Juneau, Alaska, the first stop made by Rogers and Post on their tragic flight. From the day of their marriage, Mrs. Rogers, a tall, blonde, blue-eyed, and gracious woman, took charge of Will. She mothered his children and made home the dearest spot on earth to all of them, whether it was the extensive ranch at Santa Monica or their simple bungalow at Beverly Hills. Self-effacing and understanding, she never interfered with her husband's career, but undoubtedly she was the one guiding genius that did the most to help him along the path to greatness. A lesser character could have blighted the sturdy oak that was Will Rogers. "Betty," Will told cronies, "is my manager. I try to get in a few laughs and get some money and then let her do the rest. She is the financial end of the firm." When guests came to the home, Will always acted as if they had come to call on her rather than himself. "Oh, sometimes they come out to see me," he said proudly, "but when they go away, they remember only Betty." Wife's judgment best. It was her judgment that Will trusted above all others. Whenever a new contract was to be signed, he never put a pen to the paper until he had first consulted his wife. He would stuff it into his pocket, according to Winfield Sheehan, his boss at the Fox Studios, with the remark, "You know, I've got to see someone about this." Will read her every word he wrote at home before sending it out for publication. If she failed to understand some reference to politics, he would change it because he reasoned that others might miss the point. If the writing was supposed to be humorous and it failed to amuse her, Will would throw it away and try again. He read all the newspapers in the town at breakfast and threw them on the floor as fast as he'd finished with them. He couldn't pack a grip and was certain to miss trains unless Mrs. Rogers bossed the job, and he always was late for meals except for breakfast. He was an early riser, getting along with 7 hours sleep or less. In an interview, Mrs. Rogers was once asked to describe Will at home. The result was a vivid picture of Will Rogers, the husband and father. "Is Will funny at home?" she said, repeating the first question put to her. "Of course he is. Will can't help being funny no matter where he happens to be. His humor isn't the artificial kind that you can put on and take off like a coat. He's just himself. He's always himself. He doesn't try to be funny. He just is. Rogers at home." But anyone who thinks that Will at home is constantly the entertainer is very much mistaken. He works hard, and much of his time is taken up by reading. When he comes home after a long or a short absence, we all rush to him, crowd about him. Everything is gay and joyous. But he isn't the type that slips into a dressing gown and slippers and relaxes. He's too busy for that, and much too active. When he isn't writing or reading or sleeping or eating, he's riding horseback with his children. Hero worship isn't one of his tendencies, and he is never particularly impressed by anybody. The statesmen and other great men he met, he judged simply as good, bad, or indifferent people. I don't mean that Will doesn't recognize greatness in people, but he doesn't change his own personality to suit others. Will's devotion to his wife and children was always the greatest thing in his life. They had three children, Will Jr., who was 23 when his father died, Mary, 2 years younger, and Jimmy, 2 years farther down the line. Another son, who died in infancy, was named Fred after Fred Stone, musical comedy star and one of Roger's best friends. Will was never cross with the children, and he never spanked them. "I had to take care of the spankings," Mrs. Rogers once said. Children, good riders. The Rogers children, before they could walk, were placed on a horse's back and taught to ride. In 1917, they caused considerable comment when they appeared on horseback at an outdoor show. "New Yorkers," wrote the New York Sun, "who went to the big benefit at the Polo Grounds last summer for the Sun Tobacco Fund, will remember the amazement the little tykes created when they came galloping out, yipping and sticking to the leather like regular cowmen. Their pa wasn't any prouder of them that day than he was every day, because whenever he thinks of, talks to, or sees those kids, he's just naturally thrown his pride into high and breaks all the speed laws on the statute books." Rogers himself wrote the captions for the pictures of his children that were taken at the time. They reveal Will's flair for writing succinct paragraphs with a touch of humor. At the same time, they show how proud he was of his youngsters. The captions follow. "Youngest cowboy in the world, Jim, age 2, and he can ride. If you want to start a civil war, just try to take him off that pony. He eats there. All mounted on their own ponies, the youngest cow terriers in the world. Bill, 6, and Mary, 4. Here we come, all in a dead run, and nobody holding on. They won't ride unless they can ride in a run. I'm riding the only opposition to a Ford. The Home Defense League on parade. The tough little bird on the end is not holding his gun right, but nonetheless has the nerve to tell him so. That's Roosevelt Rogers." The Rogers Ranch. Will loved every foot of his ranch because it gave him an opportunity to play and ride with his children. On the place, he kept more than 100 head of horses, many of them tough little polo ponies. The ranch was a tribute to his business sagacity. The first section of it cost $3,000 and represented his first investment in California real estate. When he died, the ranch was valued at more than $500,000. He had 2 polo fields in place and was credited with introducing the game to the movie colony. Rogers never stopped talking, even while playing a fast game of polo. When he was charging down on the ball with a cowboy yell, he was telling someone else how to smack the willow sphere. He rode hard and was in nearly every play. One of his favorite tricks was to crowd his opponent's horse and force the animal to veer away from the ball. Despite his age, he played a fearless game, and while he didn't have many spills, he was whacked in the face several times with a mallet while dashing into the play. One of the best polo teams on the ranch was composed of Will, his 2 sons, and Mary. They played some splendid games until Mary, as her father put it, left and went society on us. For the most part, however, Will kept his children in the background and refused to let them be exploited because of his fame. Once they showed the inclination to strike out in the world for themselves and prove their ability to take care of themselves, he sat proudly back and let them go ahead. They are not the kind of kids who want to get on by anything I may have done, he declared, and I won't let anyone exploit them simply because they're my kids. Mary seeks stage center. Mary's decision to seek a stage and screen career was, in her father's words, her own doings. When she was 19, she sought out David Butler, director, and B.G. DeSilva, Fox producer, when she heard they were casting for a musical comedy movie, and asked for a job. She introduced herself as Mary Blake and made a successful screen test. She was put to work before either they or her father discovered her little plot. Will was proud of her achievement, but he refused to help her with her career. However, he did not interfere when she went east to dramatic school and was happy at her success in the plays in which she had a part with summer stock companies. Mary continued to use her mother's name and went on with tedious process of learning to act by joining the Lake Players at Skowhegan, Maine, where she played two summer seasons. By a strange coincidence, she was playing the feminine lead in the aviation play Ceiling Zero when her father crashed in the Arctic. In the play, the leading man, father of the girl portrayed by Mary Rogers, was killed in an airplane crash. This was the climax of the play. A few days before the accident, Rogers sent the following telegram to his daughter as a word of encouragement. Since I wired you last year for the opening of the Lakewood Theater, I got up there and seen the place. It's awful pretty. You got no reason for not acting good there. Give all the actors and folks up there my love. Tell Mr. Burke, the director, not to take the play too seriously, as the Supreme Court is liable to rule it illegal anyhow. I expect there is quite a few Republicans showing their heads up this year. It's been one of the best seasons for them in 4 or 5 years. I will be up to see you, but not till the snow starts melting. Rogers attended Mary's debut as an actress in New York in the winter of 1934. As he described the play, it had a successful run on the stage of one consecutive week. He went backstage to congratulate her after the performance, and while waiting with Mrs. Rogers to go into her dressing room, a fireman passed by. Now there's a job that must be a rather nice, Mrs. Rogers said. Oh, I don't know, drawled Will. He never gets to any fires, and think of all the actors he has to listen to. Proud of eldest son. Will was also proud of the fact that his eldest son, whom he called Bill, refused to trade on his father's name and was determined to make his own way in the newspaper business. Eventually, the young man told his father he hoped to buy and publish a country newspaper, the dream, incidentally, of every newspaper man since the discovery of printer's ink. Will teased the boy about it occasionally. You couldn't ever write like your pappy, anyway, he told him. Maybe not, replied Bill, but when I get to be a publisher, I can hire plenty of men to do the writing. Will Rogers was always thinking about his children and worried about their safety when they were away from home. During the winter of 1933, a heavy downpour of rain washed out the road leading to the Roger Ranch. A deep gully made the road impassable, and motorists that crashed into it were certain to be killed. It was New Year's Eve, and the Rogers children were out at a party. Will saddled a horse and lighted a red lantern, with the water swishing on his horse's knees. Rogers patrolled the road near the chasm all night, warning motorists of the danger. He kept at his task with fear clutching at his heart, for he knew that if this one road were washed out, others were likely to be. Finally, young Bill came driving up and saw the red lantern swinging in the rain. Then he heard his father shout, "Hiya there! Stop your car!" When he saw his son, he shook hands with him and shouted, "Bill, I'm so glad you made it." Rogers never believed in investing money in stocks and bonds. He used to say, "I'll take mine in a good old Mother Earth. A feller can have some fun fixing a spot for himself, and his family and his friends to enjoy in his life. Will, a tireless fixer. He was a tireless fixer, and the story is told of his remodeling of a home he once owned in Beverly Hills. He decided it was time that Mary had her own suite of bedroom, sitting room, and bath. A contractor was called in, and the plans were made. But every time Rogers came home, he wanted something changed. This room was moved, and that one torn down. The poor builder was in despair, and no one had any notion of what the place would be like if it was ever completed. Will solved the problem, after all, when he ordered, "Tear the whole blame thing down." At the Santa Monica Ranch home, Will was always making changes in the sprawling, rambling place with its great rooms and comfortable furniture. In the ranch house, he had private quarters for himself, including a room filled with souvenirs from all parts of the globe, all of them gifts from the great and near great whom he had met on his travels. One room was devoted entirely to Indian things, many of them priceless, for the Indians regarded Rogers as the greatest of men. The latest addition to the ranch was a two-room log cabin, half a mile away from the main house, and reached only by a rough bridled trail. This was Will's exclusive private haven. He had it decorated with Indian trappings in the gay color schemes that marked the old pueblos of the Southwest. On one occasion, Will was showing a visitor around the ranch. He pointed out some adjoining properties and said, "See those pretty white fences? Every one of them surrounds a mortgage." Restless around home. Around the house, he was restless, moving from chair to chair. He was always fiddling with something, and if lunch was late, he would pick up two forks and bang them for service. At one time or another, he bought a hurdy-gurdy piano, violin, banjo, drums, mandolin, and guitar. He could pick out a few chords on the guitar, but only because they had been pointed out to him, and he had laboriously learned them for a part in a show in which he was starred. He tried to pick out tunes on the others, but was successful only with the hurdy-gurdy. Nothing could be as eloquent and as revealing of his innate modesty as the incident that occurred when he took Mrs. Rogers for an automobile ride. They decided to stop at a motion picture theater. Before reaching the box office, Will discovered he had no money with him. Mrs. Rogers' handbag, likewise, was empty. "Let's go home, Betty," he said. And they did. It apparently never occurred to him that he need only appear at any theater in the United States and a good part of Europe besides to be given immediate entrance without stopping for a ticket. Not only that, but one of his pictures was being shown on the screen of the theater that he had wanted to attend.